Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Conflict over the right to vote in the U.S. is not new. In the beginning, the question of property was at the center of the voting rights debate, but the conflict endures. This year, 15 states have new laws that make it harder to vote for the first time in a presidential election. Proponents of the tougher rules say they are necessary to prevent fraud. Michael Waldman, president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law, is the author of a new book on the topic. It's entitled The Fight to Vote. He joins us now by phone. Michael Waldman, welcome to the show.
Thank you so very much for having me.
I think it's important to note that the title of the book, or the cover of the book, says The Right to Vote. The R is crossed out and the F is put in its place into the fight to vote. A lot of people think voting in terms of rights, and it hasn't always been a right.
Well, you're exactly correct about that. This is something that's at the heart of what we think of as American democracy, and we're fighting over it today. And one of the questions I wanted to understand myself was, is this new? Why now? And it turns out that we've been fighting over this question from the beginning. The fight to vote, in a sense, has been at the heart of American history, and it's always been raw and rowdy and partisan. And just as much as some people have had to demand their voice be heard and demand their seat at the table, there have been other people trying to stop them.
Going back to the beginning, though, we didn't necessarily have partisan politics or political parties. What were the dividing lines then?
It's an interesting thing because, as you say, at the very beginning, the voting was limited to white men who owned property. And a lot of us know that sort of vaguely from our history books. And that was a rule that dated from the Middle Ages. But even at the time of the American Revolution, that started to crack and it became controversial with many people. Benjamin Franklin led a working man's revolt in Pennsylvania during the Revolution that actually got much wider voting rights. Basically, all white men, regardless of whether they owned property, could vote. This was sort of taking the words of the Declaration of Independence, the idea that you had to have a government that was legitimate only if it relied on the consent of the governed, taking that forward. But others, John Adams, thought this was a horrible idea. John Adams defended the property requirement and someone who urged him to switch it. And he said, next thing you know, women will demand the vote. Lads of 18, as he put it, will demand the vote. Men who have not a farthing to their name will think themselves worthy of a voice in government. There will be no end of it, as Adams put it. And that's basically exactly what happened. It's gone on and on, both the power of the idea, but the controversy.
You wrote that you believe that the country is at a point when it is actually moving backward when it comes to voting rights. By the way, I want to remind listeners, they're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm talking with Michael Waldman. He's the president of the Brennan Center for Justice, and he's the author of a new book entitled The Fight to Vote. So you said we're actually moving backward when it comes to voting rights now. This is an important period in history. Maybe if we look back, 50 years from now, but what does it mean right now?
Well, it's not the case that it always goes forward, that American democracy always gets better, that it always expands. There have been other times when we've moved backwards, and I worry very much that we're at such a moment today. First of all, on the core issue of voting and who can vote itself, you have seen a rather relentless effort to pass new laws to make it harder for many people to vote in states all across the country. And in 16 states in this year, we're going to have some of those new laws on the books for the first time in a high turnout presidential election. We don't know what the impact is going to be. This is also the first presidential election since the U.S. Supreme Court gutted the Voting Rights Act of 1965, which it did a few years ago in a case, and that was the most successful civil rights statute the country's ever had. Now, not all the news is bad. There's places where voting is expanding, but the core simple question of who can vote and how is at issue. But I would add to that some other things, the things that make a right to vote meaningful. We now see in the campaign finance laws and the campaign finance system after the Supreme Court's case in Citizens United, a new role for a very small handful of very large donors of a kind we have not seen since the Gilded Age. And we see gerrymandering, the drawing of legislative lines by politicians of both parties, making competition less and less meaningful. And you know, folks in Ohio have certainly been trying to address that in recent months. All those things together have been moving in the wrong direction all at once. I think the thing that gives me hope right now is we're debating this as we haven't in years. You see candidates in both parties talking about these issues as they haven't in years. And you see, as with the ballot measure in Ohio and other places, people engaging and sort of pushing back. So I think this could be a tipping point, even though we've been moving backwards in recent years.
Let's be really clear about what we mean when we talk about the partisan piece of this. Which party wants more access to voting and which doesn't?
Well, let's put aside gerrymandering, because both parties gerrymander
absolutely
with gusto where they can.
And that really limits who voters can vote for, not as much as who can vote.
Exactly right. Mm-hmm. It makes it less worth voting.
Yeah.
So in Ohio, the Republicans, among others, have encouraged reform, and as is the case in California and in other places, it's been the Democrats. But it is the case that when it comes to trying to limit who can vote, in recent years, it has been the Republicans who've tried to do that. In other eras, it's been the Democrats, but right now, it's been the Republicans. Sense in which the modern conservative movement takes its cue from a man named Paul Weyrich, who founded the Heritage Foundation, founded the group ALEC, which is the group that helps draft all the laws.
American Legislative Exchange Council, right?
Right, including voter ID laws. Mm-hmm. He said in 1980, at a key early moment with Ronald Reagan right there at a meeting in Dallas, we don't want everyone to be able to vote. And we see throughout history that often folks who worry about demographic change try to kind of pull in the reins and tighten the laws. The Republicans who have taken control in these state legislatures argue that they're worried that there's a great deal of voter fraud that they need to contest. As a factual, statistical matter, there is simply no evidence of a wide wave of voter fraud that people need to be worried about. And I'm, for example, on one of the questions that people talk about is voter ID. I'm actually for voter ID as a general matter. I think people need to be able to prove who they are to vote, but I'm against ID laws and requiring ID that lots of people just don't have. And about 11% of American eligible voters don't have a driver's license or another picture ID like that. So these laws tend to be kind of often carefully crafted for partisan purposes. One of the lessons of history is this stuff has often been partisan. Sometimes it's one party, sometimes it's another party. Right now, this has been what's going on.
Yeah, as far as the fraud issue goes, that's what they are saying in Ohio when they call for these more extensive restrictions, certainly in any of the states that have called for them so far and have enacted them. Republicans will say, well, one fraudulently cast vote is important. I mean, what we learned from 2000, as you wrote about in the book, is that it can come down to razor sharp differences.
Well, that's right, and there's been plenty of misconduct throughout the years, although, importantly, not an individual voter walking in and pretending to be somebody else, but misconduct, election fraud, in effect, by politicians, manipulating absentee ballots or stuffing the ballot box in some way, and unfortunately, a lot of these measures don't actually address that. One fraudulent vote is bad, and so is one suppressed vote. And in the recent years, some 2 to 3 million people who wanted to vote on Election Day have not in Ohio, but nationwide, have one way or another found themselves, even though they're eligible and registered to vote, have found themselves unable to do so. And, you know, the crazy thing is, we could solve these problems. We could solve these problems easily. Bolster security, bolster election integrity without disenfranchising people if we wanted to. The best thing, for example, that I think we could do is if we in this country move toward automatic and permanent voter registration where the government keeps the lists and they're very secure. That's how they do it in Canada and England and Germany and all over the place. We would add tens of millions of people to the rolls and reduce the possibility of fraud. And the good news is you're starting to see real movement toward voter registration modernization all over the country. And actually in California and Oregon, they passed a version of automatic registration. It passed the legislature in New Jersey, although Governor Christie vetoed it. But unfortunately, a lot of these laws are much more mischievous. And a good example is in Texas. My group, the Brennan Center for Justice, we're one of the voting rights groups suing to fight the Texas voter ID law. That law, which has been declared to be illegal and discriminatory by several federal courts, that law says in Texas you cannot use your University of Texas ID as a government ID, but you can use your concealed carry gun permit. The partisan mischief in that rule is pretty evident, and unfortunately that's what you see in a lot of places.
With the death of Antonin Scalia, we now have a Supreme Court that is divided ideologically 4-4 with a vacancy to be filled. How important is it for the nation's voting rights for that Texas law, which has been, for a lot of these laws that have been struck down in higher courts, they're eventually going to get to the Supreme Court. How important is it who the next member is?
It is incredibly important. You're exactly right. You know, it's an interesting thing. When you look again at the whole history, the courts have mostly stayed out of this question of democracy.
Right.
Going back to the 1840s, where there was a sort of a mini civil war in Rhode Island over who could vote and whether only men with property could vote. And it wound up going up to the Supreme Court, and they didn't want to pick who the governor of Rhode Island was. The whole thing is almost like a comedy film when you read about how they were running around with cannons and swords. Nothing worked. But the Supreme Court said, we don't want any part of this. And in fact, the Supreme Court basically stayed out of this stuff for most of a century. Only in the 1960s, when the Supreme Court said, we need to have one person, one vote, did it really step forward. But most of the time it's been sort of umpiring but not too involved until this court, where under Scalia and Chief Justice Roberts, it's been very active in knocking down campaign finance laws and in gutting the Voting Rights Act. And they took a one-person, one-vote case. They heard the arguments. We don't know what the outcome will be, but it may well be that Justice Scalia's death affects that.
We're talking about voting rights or the fight to vote in the United States. My guest is Michael Waldman. He's president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law, and his new book is entitled The Fight to Vote. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. The 19th Amendment gave women the right to vote, effectively doubled the electorate in the United States, and the 1960 Civil Rights Movement brought about voting rights for all Americans. But conflict over voting rights endures. Still with us by phone is president of the Brennan Center for Justice and author of a new book entitled The Fight to Vote, Michael Waldman. Michael, the Constitution never mentions voting rights. I wonder why not, and also is that why the Supreme Court until recently didn't care to take up the issue very often?
Well, the original Constitution, the one that the guys with the powdered wigs in 1788 did, did not mention voting rights. And the reason it didn't, interestingly, is that, as I said, white men with property, generally speaking, were the ones who were allowed to vote. Some states had begun to liberalize it. There was actually a move at the Constitutional Convention. You know, when we hear about what went on there, it was all very secret. This wasn't done in public. We know about it from much later. James Madison's notes were released. But there was a move to put in the Constitution the rule that only white men with property could vote. And Ben Franklin got up and said, no way. He was very adamant about it. And he talked about how opposed he was to anything that was a slap in the face to the common people.
Mm-hmm.
They were more worried, and Madison was more worried, about the kind of shenanigans that state politicians would be able to do with drawing rigged lines or passing voting rules to make it harder for their opponents to vote. A lot of the stuff we've seen, in my view, in Ohio and elsewhere, they actually put in the Constitution something called the Elections Clause that gives Congress the power to override state voting laws. It's one of the only places in the whole Constitution where Congress has that power. But then, so that was the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
But then after that, there have been at least five amendments where the right to vote by name is explicitly expanded and protected. The 14th Amendment, the 15th Amendment said you can't block or discriminate the right to vote based on race. The 19th Amendment said you cannot avoid the right to vote based on gender. You cannot, another amendment, have the right to vote based on the poll tax, in effect based on wealth, lowering the voting age. So, in fact, the Constitution, with the amendments, talks about the right to vote all the time. So it's interesting. It's been the people pushing for these amendments rather than, we think of sometimes this stuff happens with judges making these big pronouncements, but it's been the people in the very political fight for these amendments that that have actually won the right for themselves. And you mentioned women winning the right to vote for the 19th Amendment, and
yeah.
I sort of knew that story a little bit. It kind of gets skipped over in the way we tell the story. It was an amazing, creative, but hard-fought drive to get the right to vote for women, with demonstrations, hunger strikes, and elections won and lost.
You say creative. Is it just because we take these tactics for granted today? What was creative about it at the time?
Well, it's an amazing thing. This was before the Civil Rights Movement. It was before the labor movement. It was before Gandhi. The women first demanded the right to vote really in 1848 at Seneca Falls, in the Seneca Falls Declaration, but then nothing much happened. And it was just during the Progressive Era, in the early part of this past century, a group of young women decided they were going to actually do something audacious and try to pass a constitutional amendment. They were in their late 20s. Alice Paul and others were their names. And Woodrow Wilson, when he was elected president, got off the train in Washington, D.C., and instead of a crowd to greet him, there was basically nobody there. There was the Princeton Glee Club, but that was about it. And he and his aides said, where are all the people? And he was told they were down at Pennsylvania Avenue. 5,000 women were staging a march down Pennsylvania Avenue, many of them in rather preposterous costumes, demanding what is now the 19th Amendment. And they were surrounded by 100,000 men who were there for the presidential inaugural, and many of them drunk. And the men broke through the lines, assaulted the women, beat them up, sent 100 women to the hospital. It was a big deal. The police chief of Washington, D.C. had to resign. It got huge publicity, as you can imagine. And public opinion swung toward women's voting rights dramatically. And of course, that story, we know that's just like Selma. And it was a Selma for women's voting rights 50 years before. And I had never heard that story. And there are just stories like this all throughout our history of how we actually became the American democracy we want to be.
It's interesting. I actually heard the story, but not in the way that you told it. And it was less emphasis on the fact that how they were able to hijack the demonstrations for the president and how they were able to hijack that and turn the attention to women's voting rights.
Well, he wasn't too happy about it.
I bet he wasn't.
Well, it's interesting. This goes back to the question. At that point, the Republicans were more for voting rights mm-hmm. than the Democrats, for Black Americans, but also for women. And Wilson's political base was in the segregationist South. And he resisted this until pickets began at the White House and hunger strikes. And in the middle of World War One, when we were saying we wanted to make the world safe for democracy, the hypocrisy just became too great, and he swung to support voting rights for women. And it's often been wars like that that have called the question of what kind of country we really are.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about voting rights and the fight for voting rights in the United States. My guest is Michael Waldman. He's president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law and also the author of a new book entitled The Fight to Vote. If you have a question or comment, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org, or you can check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. You know, before the Florida recount in 2000, many of us thought quite smugly that the U.S. system of voting was the best in the world. It was inviolate. We sent representatives to observe elections around the globe as proof of our, you know, superiority regarding voting rights. And then there was the race of 2000 when it seemed to all come tumbling down. Tell us about that. I mean, were people feeling that, counting the votes there in Florida?
These issues seemed like something from the very distant past before that Florida election, and they were. And what the Florida election did, and I realize now it's a long time ago for a lot of people, so just to refresh everybody's recollection, Al Gore, the vice president, won the popular vote, but the electoral vote came down to one state, and that state, Florida, as crazy as it seems, was basically tied. In the end, 537 votes separated Gore and Bush, and it was decided by the Supreme Court. But what that revealed was a rotted election system in Florida. There were hundreds of thousands of people who were challenged and pushed off the rolls, even though they were actually eligible to vote. Most of them disproportionately African American. You had political control of the system of counting, where Bush's campaign chair was the Secretary of State. And Gore's campaign chair was the Attorney General of the state. We know about Catherine Harris, who was Bush's ally, a bit more. You had all kinds of problems with the voting machines, where they used these antiquated machines called the Vote-O-Matic, where you couldn't tell if a vote was being cast for one candidate or another. All the ways that it turned out that we had not invested in our elections and that we'd allowed them to become ramshackle. And what happened then was not only this understanding, but that partisan and political operatives, probably at around 4 in the morning that first night, said, wait a minute, in this era, it's so close, there's such a tight partisan divide, keeping turnout matters a lot, and keeping the other side from turning out could get you the election. And so you saw a big increase both in efforts to drive up turnout, but also efforts to dampen turnout.
And what kind of damage did it do to people's overall trust of the system?
I think that it introduced this idea that there must be something wrong. In a lot of ways, the Florida recount quickly got overtaken by other even more dramatic events. The 9/11 terrorist attacks were less than a year later, and the wars and everything that's happened since. But you've begun to see, both among Democrats who often were worried that somehow voting machines were rigged, and Republicans who became convinced that there was voter fraud everywhere, you saw a real decline in trust in these institutions. And in particular, again, it's important to understand that the kind of voter impersonation that is used as the justification for example, cutting back on early voting, it just is vanishingly rare. As a statistical matter, in the United States, you're more likely to be killed by lightning than to conduct that kind of misconduct. But it became a real focus. And one of the things that we forget these things very quickly. About a decade ago, actually less than a decade ago, there was a real scandal about this where a bunch of federal prosecutors all over the country were fired. And it turned out that a number of them were fired by the White House and Justice Department under George W. Bush's administration because they refused to bring prosecutions for voter fraud where there wasn't any. And in fact, the Attorney General, Alberto Gonzalez, was forced to resign because of this sort of botched effort at what wound up being a type of voter suppression. You know, you wound up having increasing turnout by voters of color, by African Americans and others. And in those states where there was the greatest change in the electorate, were most likely to have the harshest new laws. And Ohio, which is, of course, always such a battleground, Ohio had a real problem in the elections in 2004, as you remember. The lines were so long. And actually, the legislature...
In mostly urban areas, right?
In urban areas. Mm-hmm. And the legislature, it wasn't, I don't believe that someone was sitting somewhere. Karl Rove had his finger on a button and pushed the button and all the machines voted for Bush. But it was clearly the case there weren't enough machines and other things in urban areas. The legislature actually fixed that in a large respect. By creating early voting, it actually made it so a lot more people could vote. But then in recent years, as you know, there were new laws in Ohio that cut back on early voting, especially on the days when African Americans voted, the Sunday before the election. Mm-hmm. Now, there's been court challenges, there's been settlements of the case, and hopefully the voting in Ohio this year will be strong and it won't be there won't be a big block to people voting. But we shouldn't be having to have these fights, but again, we always have.
I want to turn to Bob and Marion right now. Hi, Bob. You're on the air with Michael Waldman.
Thanks for taking my call. I appreciate what you do on NPR.
Thank you.
My concern is we have the right to vote, and I don't think we stress enough it's the responsibility to vote. We don't have the voter turnouts that we should have. And then we don't have the follow-ups. You know, for instance, you know, like Bernie Sanders is talking about a revolution. Well, what is this, a one-term revolution? A revolution is about changing things, and it takes more than just a change in the office. We don't follow up as voters. We don't follow up and give the president the supporting cast he needs. And the supporting cast goes all the way down to the state legislature. We allow, we don't turn out the vote for state legislature positions. Many people don't even know what the state legislature does. And this is something that the media, there should be some, I hate to be one of these big government guys that says there ought to be a law about something. But, I mean, we have candidates come out there who, in my opinion, are barely qualified, but they tell you, I'm the guy, I'm the guy, I'm the guy. And we have people who don't really know the term of office, the duties and responsibilities of an office. And
well,
that's yes.
Well, I want Michael Waldman to address this, Bob. Thank you for your call. I mean, first of all, Michael Waldman, voter apathy isn't new. And that was something I learned from your book.
And your caller is exactly right.
Yeah.
I mean, you could have the best laws in the world, but if people aren't willing to take advantage of their right to choose a government of their own devices, then it's that in a large measure that's our fault as people, as the people, not someone trying to keep us from doing it. Voter turnout in the last election was the lowest it's been in 72 years, and that is not only because of these new voting laws or anything else. I mean, there's a whole host of reasons for that that makes me worried about the state of American democracy. But you're right, too, and I learned somewhat to my surprise, this question of voter turnout is not new. First of all, turnout was most robust during the 1800s when politics became a almost a spectator sport when there were strong political parties. It wasn't so much about the individual candidates, but it was definitely about the parties, and they were people-powered, and they were parades, and there were all kinds of ways that people got involved. There was a lot of violence around the polling places. People would all go together to show up to vote. There wasn't even the secret ballot, which turned out to be something that public voting actually made people want to vote more. It was sort of a reflection of tribal identity, like rooting for your football team. And turnout began to fall really around the time of the turn of the 20th century. And I think one of the answers, interestingly, and this is just as we have to acknowledge both that there's not the kind of voter fraud that conservatives say there are, but there has been election fraud in the past, and progressives need to acknowledge that. I think that it turns out one of the key answers is stronger political parties. And a lot of Americans, we're all sick of partisanship. We're sick of, you know, we all think parties are part of the problem, but they actually do more than just about anybody to turn people out and keep them engaged. And we need to find a way to build parties for now. We're not going to have torchlight parades, but we've got social media, and we need to find a way to make this democracy something meaningful for people day in and day out, as the caller suggests.
You made an interesting observation, as far as that goes, if people couldn't watch their favorite teams together, if they couldn't go to the bar and have beers over it, if they couldn't talk sports every day, it would wither on the vine. Organized sports would wither on the vine. And really, our culture, as far as how we relate to our political parties, has certainly changed over time. It's something you don't talk about in polite company, practically.
Well, and it's interesting. I'm for the secret ballot.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As it was known, the Australian ballot, which is government prints the ballots and they're in secret, and I certainly wouldn't want to change that. But it is akin to saying you can root for whatever team you want to root for, but you have to do it in private, and you can't let people know what you're doing. And no tailgating, whatever you do, no tailgating.
Right.
So I wrote that in a draft of this book, and one expert said, yeah, but, you know, people actually engage with sports differently than they used to. There's sports betting. There's ESPN.com. There's fan groups on Facebook. And so, you know, people find a way to be with each other when it comes to rooting for the team, even if they're not at the stadium. And so the challenge for people engaged in American democracy and politics today is how do we not have just sort of a passive consumer culture, but a way to engage people where they live and how we all live now.
Do you think that might include a real third party?
Well, you know, it's if we lived in Europe, we've got the two-party system that's pretty baked in.
Mm-hmm.
And if we lived in Europe, say, there would be a Trump party, which would be sort of a right-wing nativist populist party. There might be a Rubio Jeb Bush party. There might be a Hillary Clinton party, and there might be a Bernie Sanders party. And that kind of thing can help. One of the other things that caused the drop in voter participation was there used to be a lot more third and fourth and fifth parties. And in the 1912 election, you had the Republicans and the Democrats, and you had Teddy Roosevelt running on the progressive ticket. And you had Eugene Debs as a high-profile socialist, the last one, before this one. And, one of the things I learned, we're used to all sort of thinking that our system was designed to avoid these parties. And we all remember that James Madison wrote in the Federalist Papers that faction, as they called it, was the enemy of good government, and that the whole system was designed to avoid parties, in effect. Well, 4 years later, Madison was out there organizing a party, which we now know of, in effect, as the Democratic Party, and he changed his mind publicly, and he wrote essays he called a candid state of parties, and he said, you know what, I was wrong. Parties are really important. And we need to organize them and have everybody be able to participate in them. So it's actually been, even the founders saw that this was a good way to get people involved from the start.
We're talking about voting rights in the United States. My guest is Michael Waldman. He's president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law, and he's also the author of a new book. It's entitled The Fight to Vote. Questions or comments, give us a call, 614-292-8513. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. We're talking today about the history of voting rights in the United States and how voter rights remain a major point of controversy. Still with us by phone is president of the Brennan Center for Justice and at the NYU School of Law and author of a new book. It's entitled The Fight to Vote. Michael Waldman, Hillary Clinton has gone further than most in addressing the issues of voter rights. She's called for something that's being looked at in California and Oregon, as you mentioned earlier, universal automatic registration. What are the arguments against that?
Well, you're right. Hillary Clinton has been very outspoken over her whole career, actually. When she was a senator, she sponsored something called the Count Every Vote Act, which was the sort of the best voting bill of its time. And she's been quite out there urging universal and automatic registration. The arguments against this, there's a philosophical argument and there's a sort of a practical argument. The practical argument is that somehow the wrong names will be on the rolls, that that people who are not eligible to vote because they're, say, they're not citizens or something like that would somehow end up on the rolls. And those are important questions, and they are actually have been addressed or addressable. Basically, people have the option of saying, no, I'm not eligible, and you don't want people who are not eligible to be on the rolls. But as a general matter, those are the practical arguments, but the philosophical argument is that voting shouldn't be too easy. We shouldn't make it too easy for people to vote. Voting is not a right, in effect, but a privilege. And if you can't be bothered to get yourself on the rolls, well, you probably shouldn't be voting. And you sometimes hear that from people. But really, we actually have a more complicated voter registration system in this country than other countries. When people move from place to place, they fall off the rolls. Our government has all different kinds of lists that we're all on, all different ways, and we ought to use that to make sure everybody gets to choose the government. So there isn't such a strong argument against it. People say, I don't think it's been engaged with just yet on that level. And interestingly, while it didn't go as far as the automatic universal proposal, a commission that was appointed by President Barack Obama that was led by Mitt Romney's lawyer, Ben Ginsburg, as well as Bob Bauer, who was the Democrats' top election lawyer, basically embraced this idea of modernizing voter registration as one of the answers. So I like to think there's actually a potential, there's a potential there for consensus. So that may be a foolish hope.
Iris in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Iris.
Hi. I'd like to make a comment about the very effective voter suppression in the presidential 2004 election campaign. I live in North Linden. My neighborhood is very diverse. I've been in the same area and the same precinct since 2002. Normally, voting time was 3 minutes. Get in, vote, and out. Mm-hmm. November 2004, I wound up standing in line for 5 hours waiting to vote. It was very effective at limiting it. And by the way, I'm really looking forward to getting and reading your book.
Well, that's very kind of you. And as you know, just as Florida was the determinant in 2000, Ohio was in 2004. If 60,000 votes had changed in Ohio in 2004, John Kerry, although he didn't get as many popular votes nationwide as George W. Bush, John Kerry would have won. In this very tight, closely contested partisan environment, voter suppression tactics can make a big difference. I think the country has done better since then. But unfortunately, the U.S. Supreme Court, by knocking out one of the main pillars of protection for voters, put us much more at risk in this election than we would be otherwise. And again, the kind of political push by conservative Republicans in Ohio and elsewhere to cut back on early voting and other things also put things at risk. Although, as you know, there was a big fight back in Ohio. The Democrats threatened to have a ballot measure to repeal the legislature's voting bill, so the legislature repealed it, most of it. And you saw this become a big battle all over the country. I hope very much that even though there's these 16 new laws, that in the end it's not going to matter very much in terms of people being able to exercise their democratic rights. But we have to be very vigilant all year long.
Iris, thanks a lot for that call. I want to turn now to Justin in Columbus. Hi, Justin, you're on the air.
Hi, Ann. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is about why voting is on November 2nd. I understand the historical context and why it was originally chosen to be the National Election Day, but it's not really applicable to modern times. So is there any reasonable argument for not changing voting day to a weekend or to making it a national holiday?
And you mean the first Tuesday in November?
Yes, ma'am.
Right. Okay. Yeah.
Well, it's a great question, and I think a lot of people would probably think, well, that must be in the Constitution, right? and it isn't. The nationwide election day of the first Tuesday after the first Monday in November was put into federal law in the 1840s for the convenience of farmers of the time. They needed to have a day where you need to be able to take your horse and buggy to the county seat to vote and get back in time for your farming duties and so forth. And so nonetheless, we remain, and they wanted one election day nationwide because previously people had gone from state to state voting. It was called pipe fitting for some reason. That's why we have this rule, and it is one of the things that drives voting rates down. Now, the country, without even really realizing it has been doing it, has moved past that in a lot of ways. Early voting is very, very popular. If this were a consumer product, it would be a very popular consumer product. And you see it up to a third of people voting early all over the country at a much more convenient time for them. Some places are moving toward vote by mail, although
Oregon always already does that.
Oregon does that, and it's much more accessible in other places, though I personally strongly prefer early voting in person. I think, among other things, there's greater protection against fraud. There's been proposals, as the caller suggests, to move voting to the weekend to make it maybe 2 days. You don't want to have it on a day that's, you know, the Sabbath for Christians on a Sunday or Jews on a Saturday. You have to be careful with people's religious approach. But there are all different kinds of ways of doing it, multiple days. Some have said, well, let's at the very least make Election Day a holiday. That would give a lot more people time off. Although, of course, as we know, if you go to a shopping mall on a federal holiday, that may just mean that the people in the retail stores have to work while the rest of us shop. So, there's no perfect solution. But there, again, if we viewed this, if this were a private company, if this were a private company running its product rollout the way we run our elections, it wouldn't do very well in the marketplace.
Justin, thanks a lot for that call. Now, Joseph in Columbus, you're on the air. I'm sorry, Joseph. I mean, there's so many calls. James in Pataskala, you're on the air.
Oh, this is James.
Yep.
I wondered what the guests would think about some sort of tax credit for voting. I mean, just something that simple. I understand it wouldn't improve the quality of the vote, but it would probably improve the quantity.
And there's even a rationale for something like that, in the sense that a lot of people lose money when they go vote because they work, and they work in jobs where they get paid hourly. And if they have to take 5 hours to vote, it's not just an inconvenience. It's really something that it's hard for them to afford. Mm-hmm. And it is the case also that in the past, when turnout was higher, a lot of times the kind of corrupt political machines of the 1800s actually did pay voters to vote. I think it is the kind of thing we ought to be looking at, tax credits or other benefits. And some cities around the country are trying to experiment with this, but there are laws in place that are very understandable, that say, well, we really don't want to pay people to vote, and there's a risk of corruption. But I think we could find we could certainly find ways to make it in people's interests so that they actually do turn up and vote in a more direct and immediate way.
James, thanks a lot. We have time for maybe one more call. Dale in Worthington, you're on the air. Hi, Dale.
Hi. I'm in mid-60s, and I've been around for a while, and I've been appalled by what laws and particularly the Supreme Court has done to elections in this country and state legislatures. But I have to go back to 1971 where, I was abused by the police and protesting the 18-year-old vote. I was part of a SDS, the Student for Democratic Society. But I have to look on it fondly now because the youth vote has been very, very important in the last two cycles and probably in this cycle too. So I'm optimistic, okay? I'm not happy with what's happened over the last decade or so, even farther, but I'm optimistic. I really am. I think mandatory. Congress should say everybody should have to vote, period. No ifs, ands, or buts.
Well, I mean, some people vote by not voting. Dale, thanks a lot for that call. Michael Waldman?
Well, some countries do have mandatory voting, and actually President Obama has said he thinks it might be a good idea. And when you have a system like that, you can say none of the above.
Mm-hmm.
While I might personally think it's a good idea in the sense that, hey, we have to all serve on juries, and we have to pay our taxes, and that's deemed to be an important part of our civic obligation, I also think our country is so libertarian in its underlying views that people would never really ultimately go along with that. But I agree with the caller that we need to remember people have had to fight for their voice, and there's always been people fighting against it. The issue of wealth from the founding with the property requirement to today with Citizens United has always been part of it. And things have sometimes moved backwards, but broadly, they've moved forwards. We went from not being a democracy by any stretch of the imagination to being one of the widest democracies the world has ever known. And I think that the broad trend of this is to give power to the people. But there are moments, and I'm afraid we're in one right now, where if we don't remember the history but also fight for what we've fought for our voice and our rights, where things can move backwards. I do think there's a wave of exciting pushback. You hear candidates talking about it, Hillary Clinton talking about voting reform, to a lesser degree campaign finance reform, Bernie Sanders, obviously, and the Democrats talking about campaign reform, Donald Trump saying he's the only one who can't be bought by big contributors on the Republican side. People are focused on not just what government does, but how the democracy works in a way they haven't been in a long time. And that gives me nervousness and also hope.
Michael Waldman, thank you so much for joining us today. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Michael Waldman, his new book is entitled The Fight to Vote. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.